to go back to the beginning. I'm going to be talking about learner evolution, in particular about exact solutions of the learner equation. The lectures that I'm giving today and tomorrow reflect work done with a large group of coworkers who are acknowledged here. Today's lecture will mostly be about exact solutions to the learner equation, and tomorrow's lecture will be mostly about the fusion-limited aggregation, a thing which is not precisely conformally invariant, but has otherwise many similarities to learner evolution. I'm going to give up on this overhead projector about a third of the way through the talk. Most of what I have to say can best be done with a blackboard, and I will appreciate going back to the old-fashioned technology. I'm going to look at the shapes generated by learner evolution and the analysis which describes these shapes. I'll be especially interested in the situation in which the trace comes back and touches the real axis. There are a whole bunch of references, that is, papers, that are either reflected in the talk today or in parallel to it. In this context, I should mention this last reference, which does asymptotic analysis of a touching problem, just like the analysis that I am going to be doing, but a slightly more specific. All of us have seen this picture, I suspect. This picture describes the kinds of different behaviors we may expect from SLE, SRAM learner evolution, stochastic learner evolution. What happens is that the SLE process cuts away some portion of the Z plane. The work today will be all about, of course, the relationship between one plane, which I might call, or half plane, which I might describe as Z, and another half plane, which I might describe as W. And the relationship between these two. In the Z, or physical plane, what we see is a trace, which for kappa between 0 and 4 is simply a simple curve, which comes up off of the real axis and goes off someplace without ever intersecting itself. For kappa between 4 and 8, there are occasional touchings of that curve with itself. And for kappa bigger than 8, the curve crosses and touches itself so many times that it's best viewed as having cut out an area in the Z-plane and completely covered that area. I'm going to be talking about learner evolution examples today, which are rather similar to all three of these cases. Okay, so I'm going to be doing exact solutions of the learner evolution equation, this equation here. Try to figure out this equation here. There's a trivial case which we all know how to solve, constant forcing. You let this forcing C of t be equal to 0, then you get the equation in which dg dt is 2 over g, and then what this becomes is patience will run out with this thing pretty soon. How do I do it? I have to do it on here because I can't turn on the lights. So let's do it on here for a little bit. the equation becomes one in which dg squared dt is equal to 4, and then that integrates to g squared is 4t plus a constant of integration. However, we wish to solve this equation with initial conditions that sets g equal to z at time 0. Therefore, this constant of integration is a function of z, and that function is in fact z squared, from which we could infer a g is plus or minus z at time 0. This has singularities on the line z is 2it. So the trace, that is the locus of singularities, looks like this, and then you come up and this goes up as t to the 1/2. Okay, we all know about that. A slightly less trivial situation, and one illustrative better of the general properties of the Lerner equation, is the situation in which the forcing is proportional to t. C of t equals t. Then what you do is you make the transformation from the variable g to the variable h, which is g minus c of t. When you make that transformation, you get the equation dh dt is 2 over h minus 1. And that equation can be solved exactly because you have eliminated t from it. I'm reiterating what we all learned in our first year or second year ordinary differential equations course. And so what you do, you learn to do in that course, is move all this stuff off the left-hand side of the equation. There it is. It's done. And on the right-hand side of the equation, you take dt. And on the left-hand side, you keep dh. And then you can integrate this and integrate that. The integration of the left-hand side of the equation gives us this function, k of h. The integration of the right-hand side of the equation gives us, once again, t plus some constant, which depends on z. And if we want to have the solution h equals z at time t equals 0, h is g minus t, at a time t equals 0, h is z, h is g. If we want to have that solution, we choose this constant of integration to be the same function of z as on the left-hand side, and we end up with this equation. Now, this singular line arises because g becomes equal to the forcing. That is, we set g equal to t, and then we get the value of z, which becomes the trace. The trace is called in everybody's notation, but the notation of that goes on later on in this talk, gamma of t. You set g equal to t, and this equation becomes an equation for gamma of t, equation of this structure. And now we're going on to your second or third year as a student of mathematics, in which you learned how to do asymptotic analysis. Or, if you're a sufficiently modern and recent student, you never learned it. So I will tell you just a tiny bit about how to do that. Okay, you want to take the equation for the trace. Here it is. And you want to understand what the equation for the trace looks like as a function of time. You do know that there is a theorem, and the theorem states that the trace is a simple curve, not intersecting, whenever the forcing is sufficiently smooth. Sufficiently smooth means more smooth than t to the 1/2 power. And when it's smoother than that is, for example, having no singularities whatsoever, then you have a simple curve, and we can solve for it. To lowest order, if we're going towards t equals infinity, to lowest order, you see that gamma of t equals t, because the logarithm doesn't count in comparison to t as t goes to infinity. To the next order, we say, well, to the lowest order, gamma of t equals t, since none of the other stuff counts in comparison to t as t goes to infinity. To the next order, we will put a t in there. The logarithm becomes a logarithm of a negative number, and we choose the branch of the logarithm, which gives us a pi I, and we then get gamma of t is t plus 2 pi I plus the logarithm of the negative of this, which is log of t over 2 minus 1 when you take into account this other term. And so we see a trace which looks like the following. Look like something as soon as I find an eraser. Here's an eraser. For small times, it comes up linearly. For small times, it doesn't matter what the forcing does. The forcing is irrelevant. Then, as time goes on, what happens is that this term cuts in. We know what happens asymptotically as t goes to infinity. You get a curve which goes off to the right, proportional to t. You have a constant imaginary term, and the curve looks like that. And you can then easily and smoothly make the connection. This is then what the forcing looks like in this trivial case in which C of T equals T. I need the overhead projector here because I have one or two curves which are computer generated. And so here is a curve which has the same content as that but better light on it. And you can see that what happens is that the curve comes up as if there was no forcing from at time zero, and then goes over and becomes asymptotic to the line plus 2 pi I as time goes to infinity. If you follow what the actual forcing is doing, at the time shown here, the forcing is about out here. The forcing continues to move to the right with speed 1 proportional to t. The trace also moves to the right with speed essentially equal to 1 plus a correction in 1 over t. And what happens is that the trace follows the forcing but lags a little bit behind it. That's sort of all we learned from this exact solution, or at least all I could learn from the exact solution. The trace wanted to follow the forcing. The trace follows a little bit behind. Can't quite keep up with it. We're continuing the situation in which the trace looks like a curve. And now we will go down to a situation in which the forcing has a square root singularity in it. For general forcing, as I have said, we cannot solve the equation exactly, but we know a lot about the solutions. In particular, a solution with a square root in it is on the boundary between being one which touches itself or the real line, and which does not touch. If the singularity were stronger than the square root, for example, if it were a cube root, then we would have a touching. If the singularity were weaker than the square root, we would not. And now I'm going to show you a the general solution. Joan Lind, at the same time as this work was being done, also did analysis in which she looked at forcing of this kind, and through an elegant technique of talking about how fast the forcing moves in comparison to how fast the function G moves, she got a result analogous to ours, but more analytic and better. That's a good word for it. Better. More analytic. But let's follow through on the exact solution and see what that does. One makes a change of variables. One doesn't change the slide until one says what the change of variables is, especially in a partially darkened room. But here we go. I'm back. So we're looking at a forcing like this, and we make a change of variables using capital G is small g divided by the square root of 1 minus t to the 1/2. That makes the various terms in the equation all of the same order of magnitude, in all of the same power of 1 minus t to the 1/2. When you make that change, then you can write an equation for capital G. And the equation for capital G once again has the time out of the equation. The time variable that is left in the equation is tau, which was on the last slide, and is minus the logarithm of 1 minus t. Tau is minus the logarithm of 1 minus t, and capital G is small g divided by the square root of 1 minus t. The equation now has a form in which tau drops out. It involves the two parameters y plus and y minus, which is kappa to the 1/2 plus or minus kappa minus 4 to the 1/2 power. As you can see, those two parameters change from being complex to being real. Yes, that's right. Those two parameters change from being complex to being real at kappa equals 4. For kappa less than 4, the parameters are complex. For kappa bigger than 4, they are real. And the structure of the equation is once again such that you could solve it by moving all of the structure in G onto the left-hand side of the equation and all of the structure in tau onto the right-hand side of the equation. Now we have a function H of G which involves logarithms and involves these two things, Y plus and Y minus, and has the solution. Now, you have seen this twice before. This is the third time that I go through exactly the same form of words. Has a solution which there's a function of g obtained by integration equal to the time variable, which is the logarithm of 1 minus t, plus a constant of integration which depends on z, and that constant of integration is going to be set by what happens at t equals 0. At t equals 0, it has to be h of z so that we can return to the solution in which g is equal to z. The solution then takes this form, and now I am in a position where I can show a few transparencies and get out of the transparency business. So let me continue showing my last few transparencies. You remember that in the unforced case, we had a solution of exactly the same structure, except instead of h, we had z squared. Now I want to do something about the interpretation of the solution and looking at how the touching occurs. The touching is not so much of a mystery, but it is a little bit of a mystery in the context of the stochastic evolution. You can't pin down so easily what's going on in the stochastic case. Here we can pin down precisely what is going on. Here we can see exactly what the solution looks like. Let's return to the equation for H, which I will put up on the board, and then see what we are going to be doing about how the solution behaves, particularly in the limit as t goes to 1 and touching occurs. We'll first look at the trace gamma of t, which I call in the next few slides z sub c of t. It is a critical curve. And this is not a bad notation, but it's not the notation anyone else uses. And then I will look particularly at the behavior as time goes to 1, the behavior of the trace, and indeed of the functions z and g, and see how they work together. For kappa less than 4, the two parameters in the solution of the equation are complex. The equation for the trace becomes the one given on the slide here, involving logarithms. I have taken that solution asymptotically towards the limit of t goes to 1. I'll show you as I get the blackboard more about how to do that. And then what one gets is curves that look like this. For kappa equals 1, you get a curve. They've all been shifted, so they start at the origin, all of these different curves. For kappa equals 1, the trace looks like this and comes up. Now, where it comes up over here, you can't see it because it's a tiny structure, but it curls around and round and round, forming a logarithmic spiral. For kappa equal 2.5, you can see more of that spiral. 3.5, you can see more of it. 4, well, you can't see more of it at all because, in fact, the spiral truncates by hitting the real axis. That's what happens for kappa less than 4. For kappa bigger than 4, there's a set of touchings. And here we have the same kind of picture. Here we have the same picture drawn again. And the same kind of picture now for kappa bigger than 4. What you have is this curve kappa equals 4 repeated. 4.5. You see that the angle at which the touching occurs becomes, here the angle is 180 degrees by some standards. Here it's 90 degrees. Stand straight up and this whole curve is a semicircle. Here the angle is becoming more acute, more acute. It would become more acute for larger values of kappa. What we see is intersections at different angles which depend on kappa. We always see, no matter what we're doing, that the curve comes straight up from the real axis at t equals 0. This is the asymptotic form of... let me start putting this on the board. Okay, enough of these transparencies. They're a pain in the neck. The more modern way with PowerPoint is more of a pain in the neck. Let's go back to ancient history. I actually haven't done a talk with chalk for ages, but clearly, if you're constructing something, chalk is the best way to do it. Okay, a little bit of copying. I want to stick with this on the board. The basic solution is that some function called h of G divided by the square root of 1 minus T plus the logarithm of 1 minus T is some function, the same function called H, which depends on Z. And H of Z is 2y plus divided by y plus minus y minus the logarithm of z minus y minus minus 2y minus the logarithm of z minus y plus, and y plus or minus is the square root of kappa plus or minus the square root of kappa minus 4, and now we're going to be working for a while for a kappa greater than 4, which means touching of the real axis. The first thing we are going to look at is the trace. The trace is gamma of t, and it depends on the logarithm of 1 minus t. In order to obtain the trace, you set g equal to the forcing. G is going to be equal to the forcing, and the forcing, which is the last setup thing that should go on this blackboard, is the square root of kappa times 1 minus t. So to get the forcing, you have h of 2 times the square root of kappa. This is an equation, then, for the forcing, and it involves this relatively elementary but not quite trivial function. The next thing to do in this very traditional mode of analysis is you look at the singularities of h of z. Where does something interesting happen to h of z? For example, as z goes to infinity, h of z approaches, we get a log z from there and a log z from there. Y plus minus y minus cancels out, and we get h of z goes to twice the logarithm of z, and that in turn goes to infinity. As we go to y minus, as z goes to y minus, h of z goes to 2y plus over y plus minus y minus times the logarithm of z minus y minus, and that goes to minus infinity. As z goes to y plus, h of z goes to 2y minus over y plus minus y minus, a minus sign, a logarithm of z minus y plus, and that goes to plus infinity because of this minus sign. Y minus and y plus are both positive. Y plus is bigger than y minus. And finally, as z goes to y plus plus y minus, which is twice the square root of kappa, which is the coefficient of the forcing, what we get is that h of z goes to some constant plus another constant times z minus y plus plus y minus, all squared. And what you do here is that you lose the inverse. H inverse has its infinite derivative. you lose the conformality at this value of z. And so not conformal, not one-to-one. And now I go back and draw my pictures again. Or rather, let's go here. I want to do the asymptotic analysis in the limit as t goes to 1, and therefore this goes to minus infinity. If I'm going to get any cancellation at all, I'm going to have to have h go to minus infinity. If I have h go to minus infinity, that only happens at y minus, and what I get is an equation which is, roughly speaking, some constant. A constant, in fact, a complex constant, has been left out by writing this, and I'll have to come back to that complex constant in a moment. Constant plus the logarithm of 1 minus t is equal to, I can probably read it from way down there, this is a gamma of t minus y minus. Apparently y minus is the place where we're going to get something interesting happening to gamma of t. And then there is a y minus over y plus minus y minus, a 2 and a minus sign. This is fun. It requires knowing what you're doing. The transparencies just help you along. You don't have to remember anything. But here, in order to do it this way, you clearly have to remember things. Because reading them off the notes is a pain in the neck. You then solve for gamma of t, which is equal to y minus, and then you get 1 minus t to a power. And now I should go back to these notes, find my glasses, and do all the hard things to do. I think my glasses look like the hardest. Nope, not here. Right where they should be. So according to the notes, y minus plus some constant times 1 minus t to the p, that takes this term into account. This y minus is that y minus, and then this constant is taken into account by writing e to the pi I times q, since I figured out in writing this what the imaginary part of that constant should be. P turns out to be equal to y plus minus y minus over 2y plus, and Q turns out to be y minus over y plus. This Q tells you the angle at which you come in and touch the real axis at the point y plus. This P tells you the speed to which you do it in T. The picture then looks like, and so I will draw my Z plane again here. The picture then looks like a trace. Use this lot, so let me draw it fairly carefully. A trace, which, like all the traces in this lecture, at time t equals 0, start out and go straight up. Then curve around and almost touch the real axis. If t were 1, it would touch the real axis, but misses by a little bit. It would intersect at the point y minus. It comes off of the real axis of the point y plus y minus, which is signaled by this singularity. And then we come in, and the point y plus is somewhere in the middle here. Y plus is bigger than y minus. So this is the basic structure we have to understand here is the picture of the trace produced by this marginal kind of forcing. Now, there's something else here which is nice, which relates to a coarse piece of their history that the physicists in this room had, but not necessarily the mathematicians. The physicists learned how to solve electrostatics problems. They've probably mostly forgotten how to do that, but they certainly learned at some stage. This is an electrostatics problem, at being a problem in complex analysis. It is a problem in which you have a function, g of z, which obeys a, because it's conform, because it's analytic, it obeys the Laplace equation, del squared g of x plus iy is equal to zero. On this red region, the imaginary part of g of z equals zero, so that the imaginary part of g of z is a potential, a electrostatic potential, since it goes to z or y as y goes to infinity. What happens is that you have a an electric field which is constant and points down from infinity. That electric field induces charges on this red conductor, and we are solving electrostatics when we solve for G, which is psi plus I phi, and phi being an electrostatic potential, and psi being the companion function, whose name I can't remember in electrostatics, but in hydrodynamics we call it an analogous thing, the stream function. This thing has phi being an electrostatic potential for a conductor which has this strange shape. And it is going to be very singular, because what's going to happen is the electric field is going to come down. It's going to try to get through this small hole and will be find itself unable to do so. It will then leak in a little bit, and we'll see the effect of the leakage. But mostly there will be a constant potential in this region, which I will call 2. Region 1 is the region outside of the conductor, and the potential will vary reasonably strongly. And region 3, which is this region here, is a crossover region in which this potential, phi, will go from being strongly varying to being weakly varying. The next thing which I want to do is solve this problem in asymptotically in these three regions using asymptotic analysis of a kind which has become familiar in the analysis of ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations. And so I'm going to next look at these three regions using this stuff and trying to analyze what happens as t goes to 1 in this equation. As t goes to 1 on the top equation, we see a logarithm going to minus infinity, and we then have to have corresponding plus infinity on the left-hand term or a minus infinity on the right-hand term. We have to have some way of balancing out. So here comes the asymptotic analysis. Questions or comments? Equations are set up on the board in front of you. Everything should be, I hope, reasonably clear, except the comments about ancient history, blackboards, asymptotic analysis, and such stuff, which some of you would know nothing about. The blackboard comments, incidentally, have to do with sociology. I'm mostly a physicist, not a mathematician, and physicists do not use blackboards, hardly any anymore. Mathematicians use them a lot. That's because blackboards are good for constructing things, and physicists carry things already constructed into the classroom or into the lecture room. Okay, so let me start constructing the analysis of this situation. W, or G, is equal, if I think of it in terms of an electrostatics problem, is a potential. Z, if I think of it in terms of an electrostatics problem, is a set of coordinates, X and Y. This is called the physical plane, and the plane of W is called the math plane in doing this kind of analysis. What I'm going to do is this kind of thing again and again and again. I'm going to look for big terms and try to cancel out the logs of 1 minus t that seem to occur ubiquitously in these equations. First, I will do region 1. Region 1, the potential is large. That means the G is large up there. That means H is a function of a large argument in the limit as t goes to infinity. That means we use the first line of the asymptotic analysis up there, and you write 2. I try to do that with white chalk. You'd say twice the logarithm of the argument, which is g over the square root of 1 minus t, plus the logarithm of 1 minus t is equal to h of z, and h of z is this well-known function with logarithms. The square roots of 1 minus t logarithm cancel out, and so I can cancel this against that, and I can then say g, which is the potential function, or w, or whatever you want, as a function of z, looks like e to the 1/2 h of z, which is then equal to 1 is equal to z minus y minus to the power y plus over y plus minus y minus times z minus y plus to the power y minus over y plus minus y minus. A extremely, completely explicit solution for this region 1 potential, which we notice goes to 0 as z goes to y minus. Our assumption for moving into region 1 was that g was big. G over the square root of 1 minus t was much bigger than 1. So that assumption fails right there, where it should fail. And we see something that we can understand completely. Plot out if you want. If you asked what was the value of z which made this thing real, the answer is all of the z's on the red curve make it real, and that is how we trace out the red curve, which is the trace plus the real axis. Now we go on and do the other two regions, region 2 and region 3. We just had in the last hour a talk about the connection between the inside of things and the outside of things. Two should be like one, except viewed from inside. However, here inside is really different from outside, because here we have the necessity that the potential G be really slow, have really small variation in this region too. We're inside the conductor, as everyone knows when an analytic function goes through a filter like this, that takes away the variation in it, and we're not going to see much variation in this region. This region is around Y plus, so maybe I should look and see what happens when Z approaches Y plus. When Z approaches Y plus, well, I shouldn't look there. Let me look back at my list of singularities. When Z approaches Y plus, we have H going to plus infinity. H going to plus infinity. That's a good thing to happen, because the plus infinity there can cancel the minus infinity there, and we can get something which is doing nicely. So we then make the ansatz, and I want to go back to my notes. Through with that, I've done that, I've done this. Oh, we're moving right along. Okay. There we are. I make the ansatz that G, let me erase this. So I'm done with region one. Finished with region one. I have the solution. I can get rid of this. We want Z. We want the argument of that thing to have G approach Y plus. And I'm going to make the ansatz G minus Y plus to the 1/2. That makes G small if I'm going to say this is going to be of order 1, especially since I'm going to say that this thing divided by 1 minus T to the Y plus over 2Y minus, I'm going to demand that this be of order 1. That means that G is going to be close to that, and because that is close to this very small quantity, and because Y plus over Y minus is bigger than 1, we're demanding that it be very close to, in fact, this. What we then say is that the argument of this H becomes something that satisfies Z approaching Y plus, and we then get this structure, and after a moment of analysis, we get G is equal to Y plus times 1 minus T to the 1/2, plus something derived from logarithms on the left and on the right-hand side. H becomes a logarithm on the left-hand side. H on the right-hand side is another logarithm. And we end up with 1 minus T to the Y plus over 2Y minus, giving this order of magnitude that I said, times Z minus Y plus divided by z minus y minus to the power y plus over y minus. The argument then is that g is very close to this. Very, very close indeed. This, it varies a little bit, only a very little bit around this small number, except when z approaches y minus, when something special happens. So through this entire region 2, we have g of order this very small number. However, it gets bigger in the neighborhood of here. And we once again have a expression in region 2 now for g as a function of z, for the electrostatic potential as a function of position. In the last minute or two, I will then look at region 3. Region 3 looks the same in the analysis of, rather the same, in the, if you look through the equations of Bauer and Bernard. However, in this situation, which is a generalization of theirs, they actually looked at the semicircle. I'm looking at a somewhat larger class of problems. In this situation, region 3 is rather different. So onward to region 3. In region 3, we have z approaching y minus. And I have to go back to my notes. I have z approaching y minus. So I'm going to simplify the h of z on the right-hand side of the equation. On the right-hand side of the equation, when z approaches y minus, I get h of z is minus 2y plus over y plus minus y minus times the logarithm of z minus y minus. You have already seen my major point about this. I'm now going to have a situation in which I'm going to solve for z in terms of the potential. In the other two situations, I solve for the potential in terms of z. Here we turn around and do the inverse kind of thing in order to get the natural expansion in the region that we need. On the left-hand side, we have unsimplified g of z divided by the square root of 1 minus t. We cannot simplify it further, and we have the logarithm of 1 minus t. We then solve, we find the behavior in this iteration, in this narrow region around y minus, that behavior in that narrow region around y minus has a small value of the potential because of this factor, and has a small value of the variation of z because of this, and we're just focusing in on a very, very narrow region. Okay, so this enables us to take the exact solution and see what happens. Now, my major question about what happens was, what happened to this region? Is it really true that this region as this touch occurs, this region falls out of the region of analyticity. This region falls out of the analysis all at once. Yes, it's really true. You go from this situation in which you're analyzing all of these initial Z's, and a 1 minus T later, you have touched, all of this stuff falls out of your region of analysis, and you're left with only region 2 to analyze, because all of this has fallen into the chute. The next step of analysis is to look at the chute. However, I think what I'm going to do is the complement of what happened in the last lecture. I'm going to start 10 minutes early. I'm going to stop 10 minutes early and pick it up next time. Next time, I'm going to be talking mostly about DLA, but also a lot about the kinds of analysis that a fluid mechanician would do of this kind of situation. Give myself one more moment of thinking about it as a fluid mechanician, which is sort of what I've been for the last bunch of years. What happens all along is that particles are dropping out of the system because there's a hole here, and particles fall through that hole. Particles, what do I mean? I mean points in Z, which form part of the trace, they move down, and then they move out of our region of analysis. What happens is that at time t equals 1, all of the points in here fall out of the region of analysis. I'm going to start out next time, I think, by looking at the Fokker-Planck equation, which, as most naturally interpreted, looks at the flow of a set of points in the z-plane and watches them disappear through this hole in the real axis. And I'm going to then analyze what happens to that. I'm going to make contact with a theorem which says that the behavior of passive scalars, a technical term for particles flowing around in a velocity field, what happens to the passive scalars changes immensely as we get a singularity in time stronger than 1 minus t to the 1/2 in the velocity field, and then use that to make contact with the standard SLE work. As usual, things took a little longer than I expected them to. I'm only 10 minutes under time, but I'll pick up next time. Thank you. I would be very tempted to want to analyze the behavior in an annulus, including constant drift around the annulus. I don't know what would happen, but it might well be interesting. I think that it's fun to, at least I think it's sort of less interesting, but I might give a, you know, who would have believed that the whole problem of Brownian motion could have had so much in it? Okay, but there are two questions one should ask here. One is the small-scale structure, and the other is the large-scale structure. And John is pointing us towards the large-scale structure. In fact, we are analyzing a problem which is richer, but not so entirely different from what you just said. We added Levy flights. We, Grusberg, and a couple of graduate students and myself, we added Levy flights to the Brownian motion. And so what you have is a large-scale structure, which is quite different from the small-scale structure. Nobody said that the only thing that was interesting in the world was a fully scale-invariant structure. Things that are only partially scale-invariant, say, have one scale-invariance on a small scale and another scale-invariance on a large scale, are interesting and can give you insight into what you are doing in the SLE, because the SLE with its Z goes into 1 over Z may confound differences between large scale and intended to confound differences between large scale and small scale structure. Yes, I believe we do have that. I think that Joan Lynn's theorem, is she here? is strong enough so that she can argue what happens with SLE. What you have to have is a, as you know, as I didn't tell most of the experts in this room, what you need is an orbit that can stick on the real axis. That is a motion, g of t, which can stick on the real axis. And that only happens under conditions which were precisely defined by Joan, if I'm not mistaken. That basically requires that the velocity be large enough so that the bifurcation, which shoves you off in one or another direction in the complex plane, not occur. So I believe if you look at her work, you see a sharp theorem which says what happens to C of T. But don't you demand that something roughly like C of T prime minus of t divided by roughly t prime minus t to the 1/2 power be greater than 1 for all t prime between t and s. I think that's sort of the condition that requires a first touching of at s. Never, never, never? I'm sorry. Okay, let's try 4. I think that's her condition. And now I'm translating. I'm throwing out all kinds of mathematics that I don't understand. But I think that's what she said. I tried to look at that, but I'm my demand for exact solutions means I'm weaker than people who are looking for theorems. It doesn't always happen that the physicists are weaker than the mathematicians, but in this case, yes, sir, I'm weaker and couldn't do it. I think that once you have a orbit which sticks to the real axis long enough, you are certain to get a touching. The orbits tend to move away from the critical point h equals 0, so that once you get started, it's possible to keep going on such an orbit for quite a while. And the Brownian motion does not, I believe, kill that. So that the oscillations of the Brownian motion still allow you, as you know from pictures, to have self-touching after a long period of time. But I think the analysis, it is certainly true that the analysis on the real axis is what you have to do to see what goes on with the self-touching. Thank you.